Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. Now, it's Kiwi Collaborator time again for you. And you know how yesterday I promised after having the Republican on that we would have a representative from each of the minor parties, which in my opinion don't get enough media coverage as they deserve, preferably the heads of those parties, onto the show so that we can record a decent interview, nice and friendly, and let everybody know what they're all about, because mainstream media won't do anything like that. And so it's in that very spirit of letting people be heard, I bring you Russell Norman, the co-leader of the New Zealand Green Party, live from Wellington. Russell, welcome to the program.
G'day, Vinny. How's it going?
Well, you know, borderlining on fabulous is my party line, so in this election I'm going to vote fabulous.
Excellent.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Now, one thing I'd like to ascertain from you, Russell, is just where the Green Party has managed to come from in terms of this country's history. What was it born out of? Who were its founding members? And would they be supportive of what the Green Party's turned into today?
Well, you could probably trace the Green Party back to the first, what you might call the first environmental party at a national level in the world, which was the Values Party in New Zealand, which goes back to the early 1970s. And that was a classic kind of post-materialist party, if you like. That is, that it was a bunch of people who were motivated by ideas that weren't just about materialism, more money, more stuff, more of everything. And so that was some of their fundamental driving values, if you like. And so that was particularly focused on protecting the natural environment. But it was about much more than that. It was about trying to value the things that mattered, such as community and people and relationships, and not just getting more and more consumer stuff. So that went on for a few elections. It it got some reasonable votes, but it never got anyone elected into parliament. And then there was a revival of the kind of green movement in the late 1980s. And the kind of modern Green Party, if you like, appeared in 1990. And we've been continuously kind of in the current form since 1990, though we did have a while when we were inside a larger formation called the Alliance with some other parties. In terms of whether there's a continuity of ideology and beliefs between those who founded the party and now, I think so. The modern Green Party these days, we're very much focused on issues of how we live sustainably within the limits of the natural world, and also very focused on the quality of relationships between people and how we look after each other. So I think there is a fair degree of continuity between then and now.
Well, we kind of talk on the show about the lack of a difference nowadays between left and right, and most people see the Green Party as sitting firmly on the left. Would you agree with that?
I think if you look at a lot of our social policies, that's a fair comment. On the other hand, I would argue that the Green movement brings something new to the table. The Green Party and the Green movement has a lot of issues that we care about, but I think the one new idea that was introduced by the Green movement, which didn't exist in the history really of political thought before that, was the idea of a finite planet, and that we can't continuously grow and expand our resource use and our pollution production, and that we have to work within the limits of a finite planet. And so on questions of freedom or equity, they have to be resolved within the limits of the planet that we have. And the old left idea, for example, which was you grow the cake and give a little bit more to those at the bottom, simply doesn't work, because we can't continue to grow the cake because the planet itself is limited. I believe the Greens brought a new element to that.
So what happens to all those people left out at the bottom who aren't getting any cake because we can't grow it?
Well, our view is that the cake is large enough for everybody. It's large enough for everyone's need, but it's not large enough for everyone's greed. So there's enough resource that we can all live good lives, but we need to share it around. So that's a kind of old left idea in a way, but it's placed within the, a different framework to the social democrats who kind of preceded us, and their view that you just keep growing it, because we don't think you can. And the attempt to keep growing the economy is resulting in massive ecological destruction, and some very significant environmental changes, such as climate change, that will be very bad for people as well.
Well, see, technically, I'm a climate denier, so we'll just avoid that one. But the other thing is, it's like on the points you agree, you come together and you collaborate. On the points that you disagree, you can kind of leave those arguments for another time, because it seems increasingly, especially in modern politics, that disagreeing and arguing about things seems to entrench people more rather than conjure them into some form of cooperation. And I see this, and the form of cooperation that does come about is usually not very good. One thing that's of particular concern to me anyway, and the Green Party too, as I believe Keith told me, Keith Locke, that the search and surveillance bill is something that's basically opposed by the Greens and basically nobody else, you know, and the kind of rampant police state mentality that people like Judith Collins seem to be pushing, you know, they're going to get it. And somebody told me that the search and surveillance bill is already passed, and it conjures up a lot of course, references to Soviet-style Russia and Nazi Germany and the modern United States. But, you know, it just really deeply concerns me. And I wanted to know your personal thoughts on the state and its ability to have overreaching power into people's lives.
It's one of the great paradoxes of the late 20th century, beginning of the 21st century, is that the new right came to dominate politics in the English-speaking Western world throughout the 80s and 90s. And supposedly it was based on the idea of small government. And then they started to introduce a series of extremely intrusive surveillance state activities, and we now live in societies where the level of surveillance is greater than anyone's ever experienced really before. And so on the one hand they told us they're into freedom, and on the other hand they have now introduced massive levels of surveillance of all of our activities. So, you know, the Green Party has long taken a view that we support personal freedom and personal liberty, and that means freedom from constant surveillance from the state. We accept the necessity of taxation. We think taxation's an essential part of living in a civilized society, and so that we have public health and public education systems. But we don't believe that we need to live under constant surveillance from the government, and that's where the parties of both the Labor Party and the National Party here have taken us, and we think that's a great loss.
Well, and that's the primary reason why I want to have all the minor parties on the show, Russell, because in my opinion, it's the minor parties that are on the fringes that provide different ideas and provide a different direction for the country to go in, and the major parties, well, basically, if we have a look at their track records, both the Labor and National Party both have gotten this country into astronomical amounts of debt. Both have sold out its assets. Both have taken away our rights, freedoms, liberties, and both have made the cost of living much worse, and both have increased more draconian measures to curtail our otherwise, you know, free, happy-go-lucky lives. And so, therefore, it's my opinion, of course, that it's the fringe parties that will actually produce solutions to the problems that we face as a nation, and not the current larger ones. What do you think about that?
Well, aside from we don't consider ourselves to be fringe parties, I agree with your analysis in the sense that we are facing a number of systemic changes. Or rather, we're facing a number of systemic challenges, and the old parties are very poorly placed to deal with that because they are themselves part of the system and have created it. I mean, aside from the list that you gave, which I agree with, you could add other things such as oil dependency. Both of the larger parties have increased our country's oil dependency. And it's just, you know, that clearly the case that oil will never be cheap again. So why would you go down a path of borrowing billions of dollars to increase oil dependency by building motorways and so forth and not investing in alternative public transport systems and walking and cycling? So I think a healthy political ecosystem has multiple players within it. And so that's why our MMP system is such a great system, because it creates a space for that.
Mm-hmm. Well, what about the oil and all of that kind of jazz? Who is it? Is it BP now who wants to start drilling off the coast of New Zealand, and there's a big protest or something going on about that? You know, and the fossil fuel engine's been obsolete for 50 years or something. There's something along the lines of 6,000 patents that are held by the U.S. Patent Office that are held secret under national security. These are things like water fuel engines and, you know, goodness knows. You know, you can only imagine what technology is within 6,000 patents that are classified under national security. You can only imagine. And so our fuel price, the cost of fuel and the ability to pollute the planet, the ability to stop these things here and now by utilizing the technology we've already got is there. However, the political will, I believe, is somewhat waned by special interest groups who have infiltrated and essentially, in my opinion, implemented a concept known as state capture, where they have influence at the policy level in government. And in that process, we get denied the possibilities that we really, really need in order to make this country great. And it's just a terrible state of affairs. And in your experience in Parliament, Russell, which is considerable by comparison to mine, of course, what is the main problem you see with change, like real, actual, proper, not I'm gonna beg for it, change going on in Parliament?
Well, I mean, the two old parties are very entrenched. So you have an element whereby, you know, people get stuck in their ways and their ideas and they struggle to see anything new. You also have, obviously, the kind of economic realities press very heavily on Parliament. So the existing economic order is able to press its particular views on government and on legislators. So, you know, they have lobbyists and all the rest of it in order to protect the existing economic order and the way things are currently. So we have the road transport lobby, for example, gives lots of money to National and Labor in order to make sure that National and Labor maintain the system of subsidising road transport rather than, say, sea transport and train freight. So, you know, we have, you know, the existing economic players have the ability to do that. It's also true that, you know, we have voices such as the Greens within the Parliament because of MMP, which challenge that, and I think that's a really good development. And so part of our job is to continue to challenge that and to keep getting the message out there that there are alternatives to oil-based dependency and development. And you don't even have to look at anything particularly wild ideas to look at that. I mean, just public
transport. Oh, yeah, there's simple solutions right here and now anyway.
Yeah, that's right. So you don't have to be that wild. Just look that there are alternatives to just throwing billions and billions of dollars at new motorways. In fact, I would argue that in a world where oil is undoubtedly increasing in cost, and the International Energy Agency is absolutely plain as day about this now, you would have to be slightly insane, actually, to borrow billions of dollars to build new motorways when you know that oil is going through the roof.
Well, I agree with you on one point. They're absolutely insane. You're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. My remarkably special guest is Russell Norman, the co-leader of the New Zealand Green Party, live from Wellington. And we'll be right back after the break.
We're
Ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show on AmericanFreedomRadio.com and incidentally the VinnieEastwoodShow.com, proudly brought to you in collaboration with GuerrillaMedia.co.nz, New Zealand's unconventional news. It's the lighter side of genocide, ladies and gentlemen, so when you look outside and you have a look at the news and try to figure out what's going on in the world around you, you realise it's all effed and we're all going to die, so it's all good. And on that note, one of the people that is trusted with the protection of this country in some way, shape or form, or at the very least some of our remaining rights or liberties as they get stripped away in front of our eyes, it's Russell Norman from the Green Party. Welcome back from break, my friend.
Hi, Vinny.
Yeah, mate. Hey, what's one thing I just wanted to clear up with you. You are in yourself, you're particularly against the search and surveillance bill, are you?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. And what's your stance on judicial and parliamentary immunity?
Immunity from what?
Well, if you make a decision in Parliament, you know how Parliament's sovereign, and yeah. No Parliament can rewrite laws over the other thing. I remember you told me this back in the Mount Albert campaign. That's the kind of parliamentary sovereignty I'm talking about. Do you think that the people of government should be able to do that kind of thing without any checks and balances to the equation?
New Zealand has a sovereign parliament, or supposedly, and so that means whatever laws parliament passes, that's the law of the land. I'm not quite sure what you're getting at, Vinny, to be honest.
Well, like, for example, during the Super City, the government signed a bill which negated the public's ability to have a binding referendum, as they were guaranteed under the Local Government Act, in order to forcibly amalgamate the Super City. Okay? That's what I'm talking about. I think that there should be a proviso that if the government is going to make big decisions or something of that nature, they should be held accountable, perhaps to a jury system, but certainly they shouldn't have their decisions be completely above reproach as parliamentary and judicial immunity or otherwise sovereignty kind of implies. You're sort of protected from the outcome of their own decisions sort of thing.
So the question is, in constructing a democratic system, somewhere you have to delegate responsibility for making the law. And so in a lot of other countries, of course, the constitution is like a meta-law. And so any law that a parliament passes can't breach the constitution, and so you have supreme courts or high courts that have the ability to say that a law is unconstitutional. And in New Zealand, we don't have a written constitution. Obviously, we have an unwritten one. And that question of the ability of the Supreme Court of New Zealand to say that a law is against the unwritten constitution is not really one that's very well tested, but potentially could happen. It would depend on the nature of the law. But it's basically, we live in a system where Parliament's sovereign and it can pretty much do what it likes.
Well, and this is the thing. If you allow, if I make a mistake, Russell, I could probably, I could damage my family's life, perhaps my partner's life or something. You know, if something tragic were to happen to me because of my own foolishness or my arrogance or name your crisis. However, if a politician makes a mistake, it could potentially kill thousands of people or cause immense amounts of suffering, things like that. That's the apprehension I have when it comes to the application of laws that control citizens' lives to a certain extent. You know, like the search and surveillance bill is perfect case in point. It completely undermines any concept of living in a free and democratic society, doesn't it? Because it forces the journalists to reveal their sources and do all this. And I don't find this to be an isolated incident either with the search and surveillance bill. It seems like we're on a road of natural progression here to a certain extent to tyranny. And it's being facilitated specifically because of parliamentary sovereignty, because they can't get anybody at the tiller of the ship to turn her around because of the two main parties are entrenched this way so well.
I certainly agree with your critique of where the parliament's been going in terms of search and surveillance bill. The question is, how would you make to whom would a democratically elected parliament be accountable?
You'd have to have some kind of independent body, somebody who's not being paid for. Like, for example, we have jury systems in judicial cases. There's an idea called a sovereign jury or a grand jury or something along those lines, where if a politician does a job and they do it wrong, you can submit your evidence to the grand jury and they'll give you a hearing. And if the evidence stacks up, then that politician will be suspended from service pending investigation. That's essentially what it does. It gives a citizen activist the ability to directly question their own MPs in their own areas, kind of thing. It sort of brings a lot more locality back into the government. That's what I'd love to see.
I don't really have the answer for you there, Vinny. I mean, from my point of view, at some point or another, you need to decide who's going to make the law, and within what framework. Any kind of system has to deal with that question. In a democratic system, what you try to do is the people who make the law are accountable, like once every 3 years or however often, and that you provide certain rules as to what they can and can't pass. So if the New Zealand Parliament, for example, tried to pass a law that allowed torture, the question is, would the Supreme Court of New Zealand strike down that law as against an unwritten constitution? We don't know the answer to that. But if you had a written constitution, then at least you'd know exactly what the framework is within which the New Zealand Parliament could operate. And
I agree, Russell. Thank you very much for coming on the show today, man. It's been an absolute pleasure, and you're welcome to come back on again during the election campaigns, mate.
Pleasure. Thanks, Vinny.
Thanks, Russell. See you later. Russell Norman from the Greens. Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to The Vinnie Eastwood Show. Check us out at thevinnieeastwoodshow.com. We'll see you tomorrow.